I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing coverage of the infrastructure bill and the Democrats' 10-year, $3.5 trillion spending bill. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi delayed a vote on the infrastructure bill yesterday because she did not have enough votes from the Progressive Caucus. So the talks continue. Joining us to discuss the latest is David Daley, a journalist who extensively covers gerrymandering. We're also going to talk with David about gerrymandering. He reports that Republicans can win the next election through gerrymandering alone. He also has an op-ed in the New York Times about how voters in states like Arizona and Ohio set up independent commissions to draw state and congressional maps, but partisans ignored them. He writes, quote, "Operatives have managed to exploit loopholes and in some states shredded the very notion of fair maps before a single line has been drawn," end quote. David Daley is a journalist, senior fellow for Fair Vote, and author of Rat Effed, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, and Unrigged, How Americans Battled Back to Save Democracy. Hi, David. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Always a pleasure, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. Before we dive in and talk about your gerrymandering pieces, which are always so important, I just wanted to ask you your overall thoughts about media coverage of the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill and the $1 trillion infrastructure bill. You know, one thing that has kind of stands out for me now that we've been covering this for a few weeks is that I just want to make sure I get my numbers right here. When you look at what happened over in the Senate, you did have 19 Republicans vote for that infrastructure bill. But as Sahil Kapoor from NBC News reports, House Republicans are not on board for the watered down infrastructure, which would do nothing for the climate. And no Republicans are on board for the spending bill, which when you look at the really good pieces of it, and of course there's a lot to criticize in that too, it would really transform lives. But it's just hardly getting talked about. You know, like when you have on a congressperson from Michigan or West Virginia in Joe Manchin's case, you know, why not ask them, why wouldn't you want to provide dental to your constituents?
No, I think that's exactly right. We're in this odd media moment, right, in which, and you see the pictures on Twitter and cable news everywhere Joe Manchin goes, he's surrounded by a swarm of reporters looking for whatever morsel he might toss out. Whereas, wouldn't it be better if there were maybe one or two reporters tracking Manchin and perhaps the other two dozen were telling stories about what's in that bill and how it might improve the lives of people? I mean, I don't think it matters that much to the average individual person what the intricacies of this debate might be or sort of what the contours of the final bill will be. And it will turn out that most of the journalism from this week will have just been writing on sand, right? But there's real stories about real people and what's in this bill, universal pre-K and childcare and the things that would really improve lives right now that the media could do a much better job of talking about.
And I've asked all of our guests this over the past couple of weeks. What do you think explains this, David, given that this would really transform lives at so many levels? I mean, the Medicare expansion, just to think that people could finally get hearing aids, glasses, dental care, the eligibility age would go down to 55, renegotiate drug prices, which would save hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, sure, you can't do this in a soundbite, but you really can't pack a lot in because there's so much. And just let people know this would really change your life.
We are stuck in a broken both sides narrative in which reporters are much more comfortable talking about what Democrats say and then what Republicans say, and then presenting that as the full story. And the kind of reporters that are left after a decade or two decades of really ruthless cost-cutting and evisceration of our local newspapers, the kind of reporters who might tell those stories, you know, back home in West Virginia or Arizona, and really perhaps you know, change the way that, you know, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema might be thinking. Those reporters are gone. Those newspaper staffs have just been hollowed out, and our democracy is poorer as a result for it.
Well, the other thing is these high-level politicians will go on the cable shows, and I've watched a couple of the interviews with Republicans who take money from big oil and pharma, and then Democrats who take money from big oil and pharma, and they're not even asked about that.
No, and I'll never understand it. You know, I mean, my congressman here in Massachusetts, where I am, is Richard Neal, who is the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and I've done some reporting into the big dollars he takes from big pharma and insurance, and just the truly, you know, gross, lavish fundraisers that he holds and who's lining up to effectively, you know, stuff campaign cash into his coffers. And if we think that that doesn't have a huge influence on the contours of legislation and what is allowed and what's not allowed, we are kidding ourselves. And yet the money in politics beat, you know, I mean, instead of saying, you know, Democrat from Massachusetts after Richard Neal's name, it ought to say, you know, who he's sponsored by, you know, and the same for Joe Manchin, you know, I mean, Democrat big coal, because that is who he is. And it's who so many of our lawmakers are. They're in this same broken system as well.
There is a video going around Twitter of Senator Joe Manchin's constituents who are in kayaks as Joe Manchin is standing on his yacht. And they are asking him some of these questions that I wish more national reporters would ask him.
Right.
You know, about the money, why he's against this, because it would greatly help his state. A large percentage of people living in West Virginia support these policies. I mean, the visual of this Manchin up there on his yacht and then his constituents in their kayaks throwing him, screaming at him actual real questions. So it just says so much.
It says it all, right? He's actually on his yacht. I mean, it's a let them eat cake moment.
And then one more, because I also just want to give praise to independent media because they're really doing a good job around this. But I just wonder, like Axios, okay, Kyrsten Sinema is at the center of it all in many cases. In fact, that was a headline of the New York Times. Some Arizonans wish she weren't. People are protesting in front of Sinema's offices. July 26, 30 people arrested. June 22, 10 people arrested in front of Sinema's office. Civil rights leaders arrested. And then here is an Axios lead. This was just 8 hours ago. Senator Kyrsten Sinema's political allies have some free advice for anyone trying to bully the wine-drinking triathlete into supporting Biden's budget bill. She doesn't play by Washington's rules, and she's prepared to walk away. I mean, what kind of lead is this? And there's no mention of all the protests.
Well, and as I recall, that Axios report itself was sponsored by Big Pharma. I believe they were the sponsor of the Axios newsletter that detail is included in, you know. Right, that she's a triathlete, you know, wine drinker, has nothing to do with any of this. What I think we don't talk about enough is how poorly we're being served by Washington journalism. And at the heart of it are these outlets like Axios and Politico, who are not designed to tell stories for us. We are not who they are covering Washington for. These are subscription models, really, that are designed to charge thousands of dollars to K Street lobbying firms and Capitol Hill offices and industry trade associations that have to know what's going on. Their business model is based on covering Washington for Washington. And they've got the access. So much of their business model is based on doing events that are then sponsored by the same trade associations, and then they're the ones who are buying the tickets to these events. It's not an advertising model, right? Or a regular person subscription model. It is an elite model, and it is not intended for all of us.
Well, and I just want to give props to independent outlets because they've been doing really great coverage. Like The Nation, for example, in these times has a piece called The Budget Reconciliation Fight is Not Really About Progressives Versus Moderates. There's a lengthy piece about money and politics and how the system is so broken when you have two senators who can hold up everything. Common Dreams has some great pieces. Yes. Any other props you'd like to give out?
Oh, I think the American Prospect is doing a tremendous job of covering this.
David Dayan has been doing a great job.
David Dayan is wonderful. I think if you are looking for a place to subscribe to for a few dollars a month, there is a website called Sludge that does some of the best digging into money and politics and big pharma of anyone out there. And they've been on the Manchin story for a long, long time.
Yep. Well, and I just want to point out, we're going to talk about this with David K. Johnston in about 15 minutes, but In These Times points out that the majority, as so many reporters have been saying, is $3.5 trillion too much, without saying that it's actually $350 billion a year. The vast majority of taxpayers, you know, we forget that most people do not make that much money in this country. The vast majority of taxpayers would see no tax increases. People who make less than $400,000 a year would actually see tax cuts. I mean, we're talking about millionaires and billionaires who are going to pay the majority of these bills.
I think that's right. And that's simply not reflected in the news coverage. And I think we have got a pretty good sense of the reasons why.
Today, we're speaking with David Daley, independent journalist who writes extensively about gerrymandering. He's the author of Rat F'd, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, and Unrigged, How Americans Battled Back to Save Democracy. So let's talk about what's going on with, you know, Republicans really trying to change the political landscape in favor of suppressing the vote and gerrymandering. First off, on voter suppression, so far at least 18 states have passed laws that make it more difficult to vote. It makes it especially difficult for people of color, poor people, and people with disabilities. This is a really important one. We're going to do a show about this. Once in a while, there's a really good in-depth piece about this, but it deserves more attention. Earlier this month, Senator Klobuchar and other Democrats unveiled legislation called the Freedom to Vote Act, which would make it easier to register to vote and allow for early voting. What are your thoughts about the prospect of a federal Voting Rights Act? Because, you know, in California, we're lucky. Gavin Newsom signed a bill. Very simple. We're all going to get a ballot at home, which is fantastic. But that is just not the case in Republican states. So the only thing that would make it easier to vote is federal legislation. What are your thoughts about the prospects of anything passing?
Well, it all comes back around to Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema again, doesn't it? Listen, if you look around the country right now, it's exactly as you mentioned. You have got hundreds of bills in Republican state legislatures around the country trying to make it more difficult for people to vote, trying to put additional barriers and restrictions in front of both registration, ballot access, the kinds of identification that certain people might need in order to vote, fewer number of precincts, fewer hours, less ease of dropping off a ballot. Often embedded in these bills is a new war on election administration. In states like Georgia and states like Texas, efforts to move the ability to certify and count ballots from county boards and secretaries of state, and to move that directly to the state legislatures that have oftentimes already been so deeply gerrymandered that Republicans control them, even with a minority of votes that have been cast in the state. And what is happening in state legislatures around the country really sets up the possibility that what we saw on January 6, 2020 just ends up being a dress rehearsal for what we would see in 2024 after the presidential election then, when it comes to how ballots are certified, how the Electoral College account goes. So we need some federal action. There is real urgency in this moment for there to be federal action to protect the right to vote, because we're creating democracy deserts around the country. You know, states like Texas and Georgia and Arizona and Iowa and increasingly Wisconsin, many others largely across the South, where you're going to have just a completely different tiered system and different rules when it comes to certifying and counting ballots. So Democrats have got this moment right now to do something about this. It's a moment that they might not have for very long. And we can get into that as well, because this is a redistricting year. This Democrats have got a 5-seat majority in the U.S. House. They could lose that in 2022 through redistricting alone. Republicans control this process in Texas and Florida, North Carolina, Georgia. They're going to be able to draw themselves new seats in Kansas, in Kentucky, in Tennessee. This is going to determine who controls Congress in 2023. So Democrats might only have this small window of time to do something about this before the House goes back to the Republicans, and who knows what happens to the Senate in 2022. So they've got to act now. The urgency of this moment just could not be clearer.
So what are you hearing from your sources about where Democrats stand on this? Because Pramila Jayapal, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who leads the Progressive Caucus, said the reason why this year is so important is because next year with the midterms, you just don't pass massive legislation because you're raising money. It's going to be a fight. It just doesn't happen. So she says we've got this, they've got this very short window of time to pass these crucial laws.
I think you're right. And I think 9 months of that time has been squandered already. We're down to probably 2 or 3 months. I mean, that's a sad indictment of the system, right? We elect folks for 2 years, and in the second year, they have to go off and raise money and can't actually do anything.
Right, right.
But I think it's true, unfortunately. And so what Democrats have to realize is that when they come back to Congress in 2023, that it's a 50-50 Senate, and the map is not particularly good for Democrats. And they've got a 5-seat advantage in the U.S. House, and they may not hold either of those. So if they want to accomplish anything at all, they have to do it now. And frankly, if they don't accomplish anything, if they don't use the power that they have to actually make people's lives better and protect our democracy, then they're going to be going in front of voters in 2022 with what message exactly as they try to hold on to power? The message would be, send us back to Washington and we'll try harder in the next 2 years to do something. We'll break the filibuster then. I mean, you didn't vote harder. It's a really weak message.
We have about 5 minutes left, so let's talk more in depth about gerrymandering. And I think it's so important to focus on the fact that so much of this affects people of color. That is so important to point out. The Guardian's Sam Levine had a really amazing piece out of Sugarland, Texas. He writes about Fort Bend County. It's an extremely diverse county. This is the future of this country. 32% white, 25% Latino, 21% Asian, 21% Black. The population exploded over the last decade, growing 40% to 823,000 people. He writes about Afghans, Pakistanis living in this area. So what happened? Well, Fort Bend, Donald Trump won that district, which includes Fort Bend. Republicans could transform this district. So they keep it in the, you know, for months, years and years and years to come, even though it is so incredibly diverse. And according to this article, that's exactly what's going to happen. Texas Republicans unveiled a plan to drastically gerrymander this area. The draft map shifts the boundaries of the 22nd congressional district. So all of these people of color are in one district at not, they're not spread out. And so it's like that is a Democratic district, but the rest are Republican. And in the case of this particular area, it would give Republicans even more power.
That's exactly right. And I think Texas is a really amazing example of the kind of Republican gerrymandering that is taking place right now. You had tremendous population growth in Texas over the course of the last decade. The state received two additional seats in Congress as a result. 95% of the population growth in Texas has been minority population growth. So it's largely Latino and Asian. And minority groups, actually communities of color, lose power in these new Texas maps. There had been 36 districts in Texas. The state's going up to 38 with the addition of those two seats. Under the previous map, 22 of those districts had voted for Donald Trump in 2020, and 14 went for Biden. Under the Republican draft map, that changes to 25 Trump districts and 13 Biden districts. But it is the ethnic and racial breakdown that I think is so important to look at as well. We talked about where the population is growing, right? In Texas right now, 22 white districts, 8 majority Latino districts, 1 majority Black district, and 5 districts where there's no majority. Under the new draft map, that goes to 23 white districts. The number of Latino seats drops to 7. Mm. The number of Black seats drops from 1 to 0. So while the population growth is happening on one side, all of the power is being kept in another. We can see from the census numbers that America is becoming a multiracial nation. The trouble is that gerrymandering and voter suppression stand in the way of us becoming a multiracial democracy.
And I just want to reiterate one point here that I forgot. So Trump won this 22nd congressional district in Fort Bend, Texas by just 1 percentage point. Once they gerrymander it, he would have won by 20 points. So they're taking 200,000, mostly people of color, out of that district.
That's how gerrymandering works. You know, you when you control the process, you try to pack the other side's voters as narrowly as you can into as few seats as possible, and then you claim all of the other seats for yourself. It's what Republicans have done in Texas this week. It's what they've done in Georgia this week, and I think we're about to see it happen in North Carolina and Florida next. Democrats won the national popular vote for the U.S. House by 4.7 million votes in 2020, but they only carried the majority by those 5 seats. Under the lines that are being drawn right now, you could rerun the 2020 election on these new maps, and Democrats would lose the U.S. House despite winning those 4.7 million more seats. That is what we're looking at in 2022. And at a time in which the Electoral College and the U.S. Senate already contain this huge structural bias, the anti-majoritarianism that bends in the direction of the Republican Party is only going to be enhanced by this round of redistricting. It is extraordinarily dangerous, and we should all be ringing alarm bells about it right now.
And so then this results in minority rules, and that is what we have now in many, many cases.
That is what we have now in many, many cases, and it is what we are charging toward once more. After the 2018 midterms, there were 59 million Americans who lived in a state where one or both chambers of the state legislature were controlled by the party that won fewer votes. And spoiler alert, all of those folks lived in states where Democratic candidates won more votes and Republicans held on to all of the power. We're close to a checkmate moment for representative democracy, and we ought to be screaming about it.
Well, David, as always, it's just so important to get this information out. So thank you for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
David Daley is a journalist, senior fellow for FairVote, and author of Unrigged, How Americans Battled Back to Save Democracy. So many people are fighting against this, and David does a great job of telling their stories. Coming up after a break, we will go a little deeper to talk about media coverage of the infrastructure bill and the 10-year, $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. Negotiations are pretty intense because Speaker Pelosi decided not to bring the vote up yesterday because she didn't have enough votes from the Progressive Caucus. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. Just got some breaking news on my phone that we'll share with you. LA Times and San Francisco Chronicle reports that California will become the first state in the country to require all public and private school students to be vaccinated against COVID. Again, California will become the first state to require all public and private school students to be vaccinated against the pandemic. Well, we're going to now continue our coverage on the infrastructure bill and the 10-year Democrats' $3.5 trillion spending bill. As Arthur Delaney reports in HuffPost, Speaker Pelosi delayed a vote yesterday after a revolt from the left wing of her caucus. Pramila Jayapal, congresswoman who leads the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said, "I am so proud of our caucus. I have never seen it so strong." Arthur Delaney is a senior reporter for HuffPost, covering politics and the economy. Hi, Arthur. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you. And David K. Johnston has a really important piece about how this will be paid for. He writes that the majority of taxpayers will pay nothing. Those who make between $165,000 and $240,000 a year will pay an additional $420 a year. Those who make over $3.6 million into the billions will pay the most. These are the primary beneficiaries of the Trump tax cuts. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, editor of DCReport.org, and author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Hi, David. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Glad to be with you again, Rose.
Great to have you. Well, Arthur, I want to start off with you. Is there any new news out, or are all of the Is everyone still in intense negotiations?
There is breaking news. President Joe Biden is coming here to the Capitol right now in order to talk to Democrats at a private caucus meeting. I don't think this is going to change the situation. Having spoken to several Democrats this morning when they left an earlier meeting, they're way far apart on passing the infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better Act, which is really the centerpiece of the Biden agenda. And progressive Democrats are holding the line. They'll say they won't vote for that infrastructure bill until there's not just a deal on the bigger legislation, but actual text and a vote in the Senate. So there's a standoff, but Dems have plenty of time, so they're not in a hopeless situation.
Yeah, can you tell us more about the time frame?
There's no time frame now. But there had been one that Nancy Pelosi had told these moderate Democrats, led by Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey, that the House would vote on the Senate-passed infrastructure bill in late September. And up until last night, Gottheimer was still telling us, we're going to vote today and it's going to pass. Even though Pramila Jayapal and the progressive Democrats were saying, well, we'll vote against it. And there's a lot of us. And Nancy Pelosi doesn't put bills on the floor that can't pass. And sure enough, there was no vote. It doesn't look like there will be a vote, but Democratic leaders are still trying to project confidence. And they're hoping that Joe Biden visiting will somehow make progress. But the progressive demand is pretty specific, which is for the Senate to have already passed the other bill. They haven't even written the other bill. But after this September deadline has come and gone, there's no additional deadline for this legislation. They can take a few weeks, maybe a few months even.
Well, Arthur, I know that you might have to go and cover Biden's trip to the Capitol. So if you do, just let us know. David, given that you have written for the New York Times, you're a longtime journalist. Over at DC Report, you all cover what politicians do, not what they say. What are your overall thoughts about how the national media have been covering what's going on here, especially the 10-year, $3.5 trillion bill?
I think the coverage of this has been atrocious. Every night I watch, because I DVR two of them, all three network news shows. And I subscribe to, I don't know, 20 newspapers online. And the coverage is we'll spend $3.5 trillion. Nobody has any concept of what $3.5 trillion means. Well, I'm going to give it some meaning to you. Given that it will be over 10 years, so it's only $350 billion a year, and that there are 331 million of us in America, it's less than the cost of a cup of coffee per day. It's about $2.88. And if you're in the 80% of Americans who make less than 165,000, sorry, 90% of Americans who make less than $165,000 a year, you won't pay anything. You will get a tax cut. And you will also get all sorts of benefits, child care, elder care, higher education, a whole bunch of benefits that will make the country richer. This should be discussed in terms of human scale numbers. How much is it going to cost you? $2.88 a day is the gross figure. That's a number we all understand. Secondly, it should be talked about, it's an investment. When we burn fuel in an Air Force plane, that's just money blown out the tail end of the airplane and it's gone. But when we do the things that this human infrastructure bill would do, we are making our country and its workforce more valuable. We are investing in the future. That's not what's coming across in the news. There's nowhere near it. It's, oh my goodness, big scary number, $3.5 trillion. It's just, to me, it's just absolutely astonishing. Nobody talked about the $2.4 trillion we've already spent in Afghanistan, which will ultimately cost us around $6.4 trillion. And the last pension from the Afghanistan war probably will be paid out on the dawn of the 23rd century, based on the fact that the last Civil War pension was ran out last year. Think about that. Civil War in 1865, we were still paying bills for the Civil War until 2020.
So, David, you just described, you gave us really important information in just a couple of minutes. Why do you think what you just described is missing? And why are these, you know, I'll say radio hosts, the cable show hosts, you're right, they're just like pulling their hair out over this number. Why is that?
Because I think it's important to understand that almost all journalists are innumerate. You know, they're good English majors, but they don't understand numbers, and they don't trust themselves to do their own analysis. You know, I appear frequently on CNN and MSNBC, went to every producer of every show I've ever been on with this column. Nobody put me on. Wow. I proposed a piece, an op-ed to the New York Times, turned me down. Proposed pieces to others, all turned me down. I'm just dumbfounded by this. And the only two outlets that have had me on are KGO, commercial radio station in San Francisco, and you.
Huh.
And I'm just, you know, it is at the heart of what's wrong with Washington journalism. Everybody there deals with talking points, what people tell them in the hallway. Somebody said something. Instead of reading the bill, kind of thing I do, I actually read bills, not every word of every bill, but ones we write about, the key portions of them. And then, you know, putting numbers in human scale. It's one of the most important things we need to do. Put numbers in human scale.
Well, exactly. And Arthur, I mean, we want to give you props because you do that by actually talking to people who would be affected by these bills. I mean, we had you talking on recently talking about the child tax credit and how that has really affected people's lives, about unemployment benefits. So can you talk about this, Arthur, the importance of really letting your readers know how this will affect people's lives?
Well, one problem with that is that right now you sort of can't, because there's no bill yet. There's a bill in the House, but that's a version of what might ultimately pass, and what will ultimately pass if Democrats do succeed in passing something will likely be a scaled down version of that. I think the child tax credit is one element where we're all fairly certain that's their top priority. But even that, they could reduce the benefits or reduce the number of households that would receive benefits by limiting who's eligible based on a lower income threshold. So there's a lot of different pieces there that could happen, but you can't really tell people what will definitely happen, because they're rushing to write this and they're doing it behind closed doors. I think the top line number, I mean, I agree that it does not tell the story, and there's important context about the time frame in which it will ultimately be spent and the fact that it is supposed to be fully offset by tax increases. But I think saying $3.5 trillion helps give us, people know that's a big number, right? And this is a big bill. This is a big bill that's supposed to dramatically improve American life for working people by making childcare more accessible, shoveling money directly to parents every month, and making pre-kindergarten universally available. I mean, it makes sense that these things cost money. So I don't fully agree that you can say it's a zero cost or that the top line number is totally misleading. This is, you know, you can't say at the same time that this is a once in a generation transformative piece of legislation and then say its cost is nothing. And all you get is showered with benefits. I think it's okay to use the big number in this instance, and that's partly because you can't even get into the specifics yet.
David, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I didn't say it doesn't have any cost. It has a real cost, but for 90% of Americans will get a tax cut, so they're actually better off because of this, okay? Plus the benefits they will get. Most of this cost will be borne by 120,000 families. They're the wealthiest families in the country. They own directly or indirectly the major corporations in this country. And if we have a better trained workforce that makes that can earn more money because it's more productive, then the people who own the companies will sell more goods and services and they will be better off. That's how investing works. We have been strangling for years our investment in the things that would make us wealthier. Now, but I want to be clear, there's a real cost. It's how that cost is borne. And largely it'll be borne by the people who benefited from the Trump tax cuts, which were passed with no public hearings. The only major tax bill in 90 years that I know of with no public hearings, and has not done any of the things that it was promised would happen here. But my concern is principally that this needs to be discussed in terms of this is an investment in the future, just like building the interstate highways were, just like the GI Bill, or in my case, the War Orphans Act bill that I went to college under. As I point out in my column, in a single year, I paid back far more in income taxes than the inflation-adjusted value of the War Orphans Act benefits I got to go to college. And that was just in one year of my career. It was a very smart investment by the taxpayers.
I think you're making a completely good point. And investment is an appropriate phrase specifically for this bill, because it invests, you know, an economist way of looking at it is it invests in the labor supply. It's got all this stuff, such as kindergarten, childcare, free community college, that are things that will help people work. Whereas today, if you have a little kid, you're sort of screwed. You have to spend money taking care of them and at the same time lose your ability to earn money to take care of your whole family. And so it is an investment in helping people work, and it's never, I mean, Democrats say that, but it doesn't, it's maybe not reflected well in the coverage, because, you know, Democrats say it and it's treated as a Democratic claim. And then I agree with David's broad critique of the press here, which is that the rather than reading the text or going into detail about the policy proposals at stake, most of the coverage does focus on the fight that's happening between the and among the party leaders. And you know that's important too. But as a bill reader myself, I agree that a little more focus on the policy would be good. But then you wind up having, you have to make all these decisions about how you characterize things, and you might wind up agreeing or, you know, essentially saying that, yeah, the bill is an investment and you're saying what a Democrat said, and it's problematic if you're a journalist.
Yeah, I agree almost entirely with what Arthur said. One of the key problems here is the Republicans are masterful at marketing things. Things like the death tax, which doesn't exist, but they use slogans and very effectively. They understand marketing. The Democrats couldn't sell ice cream to children in July. They don't understand how to. So their own discussions. Joe Biden comes out and he says spend $3.5 trillion. He doesn't say invest in the future. Now he did say that, but that isn't the clip that I saw on television. And the Democrats need to go and get someone to teach them how to market ideas, how to market things to people so they sound good. There's there was some survey work done in West Virginia State, the whitest state in the country. And people were asked by the Gazette and Mail, the dominant newspaper there, if they supported the human infrastructure bill. It got more than half. Then it was explained to them what the bill does. The support went to 70%. It was then explained the way you pay for it is raising taxes on wealthy people and corporations who benefited from the Trump tax cuts. The support went even higher. So I just think it's journalistic malpractice and political malpractice the way this is being described. And if I were a Republican political advisor, I'd be saying, oh, how good this is. We don't even have to do any work. Just let the Democrats screw it up themselves by going blah, 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 blah. Ooh, big, scary number.
Well, that's exactly what one Republican did say on Fox. Go ahead, Arthur.
I can give you an example of this dynamic at play with Joe Manchin saying we don't want this to, you know, Joe Manchin is playing hard to get and will come around on a big deal, albeit smaller than what Democrats are saying. But he's saying, you know, we don't want this to be an entitlement society. He's basically saying these benefits will make people soft. And he wants something called work requirements for the monthly cash payments to parents. And those are some of the most effective Republican talking points over the past 30 or even 40 years. And it's code for, you know, kicking people off or not just excluding people who have no money, essentially punishing people for being poor. But Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat from Ohio who's a key proponent of the monthly cash payments, he said raising children is work. And it was such a good line that he put it on a poster, and it seemed like one example where Democrats could make a strong argument. On the other hand, the stuff they're pushing for is all really popular, like the tax hikes, the benefits, the prescription drug price negotiation. They have popular stuff, and people are already fond of it, but their own moderate members don't like it. So that's the big obstacle they get into before they even have the public argument with Republicans.
You know, to your point, David, you bring up another really important fact. 95% of Americans make less than $165,000 a year. And then according to Brookings, 53 million Americans, that's about 44% of the workforce, they earn just $24,000 a year. We're talking about like 10 bucks an hour. And these are the people who would greatly, greatly benefit from that. So what about this, David, as we're having this conversation about these transformative policies, just to also bring in the context about how people are really struggling to make ends meet right now?
You know, I remember years ago, the deputy White House press secretary for the Bush administration, I asked her, what do you think the typical American makes? Remember, this is 2001. And she's a typical American. I said, yeah, you know, what people who have families out there, what's the median income? Half of Americans make more, half make less. And she goes, oh, $250,000. It was $28,000 at the time.
Wow.
And 90% of Americans in 2018 had a smaller income than in 1973 when you adjust for inflation. They had higher medical costs. They had much more expensive housing costs. They didn't have pensions. Not everybody had them, but far fewer did. But think about that. In 2018, 90% of Americans got basically 2 weeks less pay than they got in 1973. These people have been totally mistreated by what Congress has done with both parties for all of these years, but they're not the people, they don't read my books, even though I make it a point to make them understandable to anybody with a high school education. 85% of Americans don't buy a book in a year. Many of them don't follow the news. They're not well informed. There's a bureaucratic phrase for them, low information voters. And that's where the Democrats, if they want to sell their policies, they need to be out marketing them and talking to people in language they use and they understand, not blah, 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 and, oh, by the way, blah, 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 which is what they tend to do. And Sherrod Brown, Arthur points out, that's a really good example of somebody who gets that. Maybe the fact that he's married to a nationally syndicated newspaper columnist helps Sherrod focus observations about this, but the Democrats should have had marketing advice on how to sell this plan. This should be a no-brainer. Big majorities of Americans favor what's in the human infrastructure plan. Mm. There shouldn't be a fight over this.
What are your thoughts about that, Arthur? David just reminded me of a piece I read about Bernie Sanders taking a group to Canada to buy insulin. And this one woman whose son has diabetes saved $10,000 on a 6-month supply of insulin simply because she went to Canada to buy it. She voted for Trump. And she said, I don't know much about Bernie Sanders. I've never heard of his Medicare for All plan, but you can bet I would vote for him next time around. I mean, that's all it took.
That's a tricky one. I mean, I don't think Trump support is really explained by economics, but the Medicare and prescription drug stuff, like people love that the most. A big part, of the stuff in the Democratic bill, it's extremely popular. It's actually something that they're using to pay for the rest of the bill. They would have Medicare. They would give Medicare new power to negotiate for prescription drug prices. And this is where the market research people and the communications experts are getting paid, because the drug industry is absolutely blanketing the airwaves, at least here in Washington. You watch TV and there's a commercial where concerned seniors have banded together to tell you about Nancy Pelosi's dangerous plan. And it's like, if you know a little bit about Washington, it's comically obvious that this is big pharma. But if you don't, they make it sound real bad. They make it sound like they're attacking Medicare, and Medicare is really popular. So there's a pitched battle going on, and there's big money spending on compelling advertisements telling you that this will actually take rather than give benefits to people.
You know, for those
David. I'm in D.C. right now, I'm in Washington, D.C. right now, and that ad is everywhere. And I suspect it's very effective.
Yeah.
You know, David, I mean, we're in our final minutes. I mean, just it's someone like you who won a Pulitzer Prize for your tax reporting at the New York Times, right?
Right.
Yeah. So for someone like you who is so well versed in taxes and you make it so easy to understand, and yet I've seen you on Lawrence O'Donnell, I've seen you on Maddow. You've called them to try to get this info out there, and they're not responding, and you're trying to get op-eds out. So what explains that, David? I mean, are you hearing anything off the record about why you're not getting booked?
No, I'm totally mystified on this particular issue as to why, everything doesn't hit. The other thing I've been trying to pitch is Arthur said something that makes this relevant, and that is, Joe Manchin says he's worried about entitlements and an entitlement culture. Well, being able to defer your taxes into the future, is that an entitlement? Being given no-bid government contracts, by all sorts of federal agencies, including especially the Pentagon. Is that an entitlement? I mean, let's have a real discussion about what is an entitlement instead of the Democrats not saying, well, you know, if these are entitlements, all these other things are entitlements. It's another example of how they, as I said, they don't know how to sell ice cream to children in July.
Mm. Well, we have a minute left. Arthur, we just did a show about Medicare expanding for dental, hearing, and eyeglasses, bringing the age down to 55. For people who, I mean, we heard from so many people who desperately need these changes. You know, if this bill is watered down because Manchin and Sinema have so much power, do you think something like this at least will stay in the bill? I mean, people whose, you know, livelihoods are riding on this bill, what should they be thinking over the next couple weeks?
I wouldn't count on the Medicare benefit expansion. I mean, I don't know what will happen. They're working on it, but that's one thing that Joe Manchin has specifically targeted. And, you know, no Joe Manchin, no Democratic Senate. So they have to work with him. They can't just fight him. And he says, well, you know, we've Medicare's finances are such a wreck. We can't be expanding it. It's a misleading comment. You know, Medicare is currently functioning, but the way he describes it, you'd think people are not receiving that benefit today. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if something's not true here. It just matters what people are afraid of, and that and various arguments about taxes hurting family farms are really carrying the day, even though they are not true. Mm.
Arthur Delaney is a senior reporter for HuffPost, and David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and editor of DCReport.org. Arthur and David, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, speaking of spending, we did a show earlier this week about how since 9/11, the United States has spent $21 trillion on militarization, a large chunk of that going to weapons companies. And you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.